Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great.
Good. Well, I think we'll start out this evening. We've got a fun topic tonight. We're going to talk about the future is now, and I know you've lined up a list of proof points for that very, very contentious argument that we're making. But before we get into that, a couple of things regarding the show that I think we should probably talk about. One is that in light of some impending urgent family business that I'll need to be taken care of over the next few weeks, I'm going to be disappearing from this program, perhaps as early as next week, certainly by 2 weeks from tonight. I won't be on the show, and we'll probably not return until June 22nd. I figure on the 22nd we're going to do a show that will be our lead-in to The World Transformed, and then, of course, beginning on June 29th, we're starting The World Transformed, and I will be back in time for that. But in my absence, I'm happy to announce, Stephen, you can go ahead and order the fattered calf slaughtered. The prodigal is coming home. Michael Darling is going to be returning to Fast Forward Radio for those weeks.
Oh, that's awesome. And it has been a long time. When was the last time he was on the show?
Well, I was listening to archive shows the other day, and I believe the last time, unless I'm mistaken, was January of 2010.
Yeah. That's been quite some time. It hadn't been 2 years then, but it's been about almost a year and a half, huh?
About a year and a half.
So,
which always seems
it'll be good to have him back. He lends a unique flavor to the show. When Phil and I are doing the show, there's a certain kind of way we do things. Michael, is like, he throws a hand grenade in the middle of it, and it makes for a very interesting show. I'm looking forward to having him back. It's great.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to have him back, and if possible. We're working on the logistics. Our people are talking to her people, but PJ Manny might be joining us for one or more of those programs as well. So
excellent. He's always awesome.
I don't think you guys will even notice I'm not around. That's all I'm saying.
We'll get to the end of the show. Well, Phil, you've been quiet tonight.
Yeah, you haven't had much to say this evening. I think you guys will be great without me. And I'll be in the background setting things up for the World Transformed.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, and a reminder, when does World Transform get kicked off?
It begins Wednesday, June 29th. And, in fact, we are working on – I do have a website that's about to come up that will have all the details on all the shows. I was hoping to have it up by this week, but I will definitely have it up by next week. In the meantime, if you're eager for details about those programs, if you go to our page and look at upcoming shows, I believe I've got the first four now loaded in there. So there are details about those programs Our Thinking Transformed, Mortality Transformed, The Material World Transformed, and I believe Humanity Transformed. The first four transformations, those shows are already loaded in, so you can see who the guests are going to be, and you can get an idea for what we're going to be talking about on those programs. So check that out. That's on our page on Blog Talk Radio. Follow the link for upcoming programs, and there are four up there. Pretty soon there will be six more.
Awesome. Well, why don't we just launch into our show tonight, then?
Okay, well, I pulled a fast one on Stephen today. I had not done the preparation that I normally like to do for a show. So I said, Stephen, come up with stuff for us to talk about. And I gave this show the title, The Future Is Now. So I don't know. I feel like I'm putting you through some kind of fraternity hazing, or you know, one of these like camp scavenger hunts or something like that. I gave you a theme, and now you've put together a series of topics that are going to demonstrate that the future is now. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And I think I can adequately demonstrate that the future is now. So let me start off with the first.
Let's begin.
Okay. 6 years ago, keep this in mind, two robots landed on Mars. One went by the name of Spirit and one by the name of Opportunity. And they went for a three-month mission. They were scheduled for a three-month mission. And today, as of this morning, they finally said, okay, Spirit is dead. We're declaring finally that Spirit is dead 6 years after it landed on Mars. And
wow.
Opportunity is still going strong 6 years into the mission. So, you know, I guess my twist on this, the future is now, we have robots outperforming all expectations. So in the future, I think that's going to be, we're going to have robots that, basically have a service life of a certain amount of time, and they keep surprising us. So that's the hope, there's my thought. Future's now.
That's an astounding story, isn't it? So let me make sure I understand. Spirit, the Spirit is no longer with us, but Opportunity still going strong. Is that right?
That's right. What happened to Spirit?
Interesting choice of name, that the Spirit's gone, but the Opportunity is still there. That's kind of interesting in the names. But 6 years into a three-month mission. Now, is
yeah.
it just that they drastically underestimated how good the batteries were, or?
Well, here it runs by solar, so when its battery gets down, they just open up its, it's got a solar panel there. They kind of aim that solar panel at the weak Martian sun there, and same sun as ours, of course, just a little further away. And they recharge the battery, and they go again. And so, and they've done things like software upgrades and things like that as they've gone along, and they just kept this thing rolling. Now, what happened with Spirit was, I'm not exactly sure how far into the mission it was, but it got bogged down in kind of a sand pit, which made it difficult for Spirit to get,
to recharge.
It couldn't move.
Yeah.
And so, it couldn't move into a protected place from the Martian winter, when it had to kind of power down. And also, it made it difficult for it to aim its solar panel into the sun in the proper way. And so, eventually the batteries just kind of gave up. But, I mean, that's 6 years into it. So, that would be, four times six. So we're talking 24 times the period of time it was originally scheduled for, if my math is correct. So
yeah, that sounds right. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I remember writing about this, when they were about 6 months into it. That was one of my early blog posts for the Speculist. And I said, wow, this thing has gone twice as long. Who knows how long this thing can go? Here we are 6 years into it. So it's pretty cool.
It's a great story. And absolutely, when you've got robots returning 24 times the value that we expected from them, I have to agree with you. We're living in the future. The future has definitely started when you see something like that going on. So,
interplanetary robots too. This is not just robots on Earth.
Not just Earth robots. These are space robots. That's an excellent point. Yes.
Yeah,
robots
right.
on Mars.
Yeah.
The fact that we even have robots on Mars.
There you go.
Kind of futuristic. Although, we've had robots on Mars since, 1977?
That's true. But these little guys can move around, or at least they can, as long as they're not stuck in sand traps, right? So, yeah.
Right, yeah. That original Viking lander had an arm that it could scoop out one time, right? That was its whole trick. I believe that, one shot at scooping up some Martian soil to see if we could test for life. It's really pretty remarkable what happened over the following 20, 25 years in terms of the capability we were able to put into remote craft and, well, robots. I think that is the correct term, robots that we sent to the planet Mars. And really cool that we're still getting returns off opportunity. So they're still getting telemetry from it. They're still getting data. Are they, you know, are they still doing experiments with it, making it do new things that
Absolutely.
It hasn't done before?
That's right. And, you know, there was some thought, you know, when the 3 months passed that, well, you know, we're good now. We got our 3 months out of it. And there was this public outcry, like, are you kidding? As long as those guys are still going and operational, you do not abandon it. There's more to learn. And you know, that's exactly, you know, they and so they had to get additional funding to keep the operation going. And so
right.
you know, every so often they have to go back for additional funding to keep it going because, you know, opportunity's still moving around and they're still learning stuff. So even when it was bogged down, Spirit, you know, that what they did was they on purpose, okay, let's grind the wheels a little bit more and allow it to dig with its wheels since it's stuck anyway and see what's underneath the surface a little bit. You know, they did all kinds of neat things like that. And so, yeah, it's still going strong, that operation. So that's very cool.
I mean, that is cool. Not only that they're still going, but they're still serving a purpose. We're still learning from them. Really, really a remarkable story all the way around. Okay, well, let's look at this next one, and this is it's time finally to get on with creating an affordable, sustainable space program. And,
okay, now two guesses as to who wrote this article, Phil.
I'm going to say Robert Zubrin.
Well, that's a good guess, but what's your second guess?
Oh, let's see. I should follow the link. How about Rand Simberg?
There you go. Rand Simberg.
I meant to say Rand the first time. Gosh. Two gentlemen,
yeah.
Both of whom have been on Fast Forward Radio, we should know.
And both are excellent space guys. They know their subject. Rand has basically long said that, you know, the NASA program, you know, basically just a big, huge government project, and that's just not the way to get people in large numbers into outer space. That's been his point for years. And he talked with us at length about that when he was a guest on Fast Forward Radio. I agree completely. I think that now, fortunately, technology has come far enough that, you know, a billionaire now can get out there, raise a little additional capital and start a space company and, you know, start putting people on orbit, you know, just maybe for tourists. You know, I read here recently that the first around the moon space tourists could be as soon as within the next decade or so. You know, not landing
well,
on the moon.
Well, these space startups, these space startups, they're talking seriously about trips to the moon. Who was it? One of the big space startup guys, my memory fails on which one it was, said a few weeks ago that they're talking about a mission to Mars. Okay. And of course, Robert Zubrin, now I'm remembering the piece that I did see by him, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal about how we could be on our way to Mars in 18 months or something like that. But I think a lot of things are coming together now, and the direction that the XPRIZE has provided, has moved us into, is tremendously helpful in seeing a future in space that I don't think we could see a few years ago. I think that our future in space was very unclear, say, a decade ago, and it seems to be coming more into shape now. And it's very interesting that as I look at this piece by Rand Simberg, I didn't even realize today, May 25th, this is the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's speech to Congress, the one where he said that before the decade was out, we would set a goal of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. So
right.
This is a really historic day. I mean,
it is a historic day. Now, you and I listened to that speech, and I just get goosebumps, okay? I mean, absolutely, to me, it's a beautiful moment. We set out this goal. We accomplished it. Rand, in this particular article, he's saying, you know, it was the wrong path. We went down the wrong way. And, you know, when he's saying we do it because it's hard, that's code word for it's going to be expensive and we're going to do it in this decade. So, you know, we can waste everything but time. And so we're just going to throw as much money at it as we need to, because we're going to beat the Soviets in space, and that's, you know, that's the whole point. And and basically now we're giving up the space shuttle even, and so the era of, you know, that was started with that speech by Kennedy is now finally over, and thank goodness. That's basically the, you know, I may be being a little bit unfair to Rand there, but I think that that's pretty much what he's saying. I would not go as far as Rand goes. Okay, I think that what we did as a nation, and yes, it was a huge government project, but it was it could not have been accomplished by the private sector at that time. We pushed the science as a nation. And accomplished this, and along the way invented things, you know, little things like the integrated circuit. You know, it's had some impact on us since then, hasn't it, Phil?
Well, I believe some, yes.
Some impact. So, you know, and of course, the private sector, of course, is now taking a lot of what has been learned because of this, and now we get to, you know, we're going. Does, you know, the question I would ask Ransomberg is that, you know, do you think there would be any chance that we would be at where we are today with private space had it not been for what has been done because of our public race to the moon?
Well, I think that's exactly the point, Stephen. I think that what would have inspired the XPRIZE if not for Apollo, if not for the history of space travel that we had established up to that point. There would have been no template. There would have been no model for what we're trying to recapture here. We're returning to space. I'm not sure that there would have been the same impetus to get there the first time from the private sector since it had never been done.
I put it this way. There was no chance of a space Kitty Hawk. None at all. You know, I mean, you know, a couple of guys, you know, running a bicycle shop are not going to get out there and blast off to, you know, orbit. It can't happen. So it was a harder endeavor than heavier than air, you know, flight. And so, you know, it was a huge government project the first time, and now we're getting to where it can be done on a private basis, and I believe that they paved the way. And so you won't find a bigger fan of the free market than me, Phil, but I'm grateful for what NASA has accomplished.
Yeah, I'm in the same place. I'm excited to see the space program move into, or not the program, but space exploration, the opening up of space, moving into the private sector, and moving into the hands of individuals. That's what I think is interesting. When it's actually belonging to people, I think that's more interesting than it being a government program, and it's more exciting, and it's more in line with getting us to where we want to go next. But having said all that, we went to the moon, and that's like one of the coolest things ever, and I think it needed to happen. And I'm thrilled that it happened. And you know, I was talking about before the show started, talking about one of the some of the archive shows I've been listening to. One, the last time Michael was on the show, it was, you were out sick. It was January of 2010, and we were going through this model of how the future happens. And I've actually been referencing this over on the World Transformed 1.5, talked about it a little bit last week, and for those who will be listening in on Saturday, I'll be continuing that discussion this week. But one of the things that we got into in this discussion of how the future happens kind of outlined the process for, you know, you declare an intention, you put a plan in place. The basic ideas about, you know, what it is we can do to make the future happen. And Apollo is such a tremendous example of that, of getting from no one has ever done this before to its reality, to today where it's the past. It's this odd thing where it's this thing that happened a long time ago, and that, you know, people you know, a whole generation has no memory of, that, you know, only knows about it as historical. But at the time President Kennedy made that very bold speech, it was stating an intention. It was, you know, this is practical time travel, to hail back to our show from a couple weeks ago, in action. This is saying, here's the future we want to get to, right? The future we want to get to is the one where the United States of America is going to send a man to the moon, bring him safely home, demonstrate to the whole world that we are the leaders in space, you know, and by the whole world, of course, we mean those Ruskies, and establish our dominance.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we show them, by golly.
Yeah, that's right.
And in the process of showing them, we accomplished something that was, you know, if nothing else, vastly improbable. It was something we weren't going to do for a long time. And I think it's great that you point out Kitty Hawk. And the thing that occurs to me, and I've had post-scarcity on my mind because I'm getting ready for the World Transformed, and we just confirmed two more post-scarcity experts for that program. That's when you'll have a Kitty Hawk for space, right? Is when we're in the truly post-scarcity world. It's possible that we would never have gotten into space at all without something like Apollo, until we got to the level where we have, you know, molecular nanotechnology, everyone has their own replicator, everyone has, you know, this tremendous technological ability to make stuff in their hands, which I think we won't have for a few years yet. That might have enabled a scenario where two people at the bike shop could have gotten us into space. But until you get to there, there's no way that's going to happen.
Right. Okay.
But I think we're close to that now. I think that I think that things like the X Prize and the current private development show that the economy of scale required to get to space is significantly lower. You know what I mean? In some ways, it's cheaper to get into space now than it was then.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I one more thing. Just the whole inspirational aspect of what was done, I don't think we should discount that. It's, you know, whenever somebody talks about something difficult or something that's seemingly impossible, what's one of the usual replies is, well, we put a man on the moon, didn't we?
Yeah, well, you can go to the moon, but we can't make Skype work very well on fast forward radio, right? It's like that.
Hey, we haven't lost hope, so, you know, we're going to keep trying. But exactly, you know, when something's difficult, we just redouble our efforts, and that's kind of cool. Okay, all right. Well, let's look at the next one then.
What's the next?
Okay, the next one. New thermoelectric materials will be tested in BMW, Ford, and Chevrolet vehicles this summer. Now, I had never heard of thermoelectric materials. You want to take a guess at what that is?
Okay, thermoelectric converts heat to electricity.
There you go. Exactly. So the idea is this: you know, when we have a hybrid vehicle, we any opportunity to take, you know, something that's wasted energy and converting it to electricity should be taken, right? I mean, and
absolutely.
So the first thing was regenerative braking. That's, you know, when we put on our brakes in a standard automobile, you know, all that energy, all the forward motion of the vehicle, you just lose it all, and so in the stopping of the automobile. Well, regenerative braking recaptures a lot of that energy in the form of electric that can be used then to power the car when you're ready to go again. So that's awesome. You know, and then there have been efforts to incorporate solar into these hybrid vehicles so that you could capture the sun that's hitting the car to generate electricity for the battery. But here's another idea. Thermoelectric materials surround the entire engine. We're talking the internal combustion engine in a hybrid vehicle with thermoelectric materials, and the heat, the waste heat that comes off of the engine when it is running, is then converted into electric and charges the battery that way. And so they're testing that this summer.
What a great idea. I see from Brian's blog post, this is over on Next Big Future, Brian Wong's blog, that the driving factor up to this point has simply been the efficiency, that right now they think they could get like a 5% boost in fuel economy, but they're targeting a 10% or more improvement in fuel efficiency. So it's not a terribly efficient process to date, but this is something they can work on and get it out also 20, 30, 40%. And, you know, you're talking about some serious energy savings there.
Absolutely. The two things that, you got working against the use of this at this moment are the expense of the thermoelectric materials and the limited efficiency of converting heat to electric that the materials have. They're working on both aspects. They believe that they can bring the cost of thermoelectric materials down while at the same time increasing efficiency in the thermoelectric materials, so that it crosses a certain barrier that makes it then affordable or economic to use them. And so that's what they're pushing and going to push towards this summer. I think it's a great idea. So there's an example of the future.
You cannot go wrong with an idea like this. I think it's a terrific idea, too. And what I would look for in this thermoelectric technology is the same kind of improvement that we've seen with solar energy collection technology over the last few years, and the trends that we're tracking there, where the price is going down, the efficiency is going up, and you go through a few of those permutations where, oh, well, it just got a little more efficient and a lot cheaper, or oh, it just got a lot more efficient and a little cheaper, and you just kind of keep stepping that way, and before you know it, you're really onto something.
Yeah, and it soon becomes a point at which there's absolutely it's stupid not to use it. At some point you're losing money not to put it in the car, and that's when it's installed in all the hybrids. And pretty soon, if the hybrids get efficient, a certain level of efficiency, we're all driving hybrids, and can't believe there was ever a time when we were allowing all this energy to be wasted. So
exactly.
I think that's a cool idea, and that's an example of the future happening right now.
All right. Well, let's talk about another post from Brian's blog. This is the internet causing world economic growth greater than the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s, and this is according to this is a report from McKinsey. That is a bold statement. Let's put it that way.
Well, I love the some of the statistics that are listed in the article. In all the countries that were studied, I believe it was about 13 countries, it was 3 to 4% of gross domestic product was directly related to internet activity. Now, I would submit to you, Phil, that another 25% had could point to some internet reason for their business being a little better. I certainly don't practice law on the internet, but I have an internet presence as an attorney, and some of my clients come to me because of that internet presence. So am I an internet business? No, I am not. So I wouldn't probably be counted in that 3 or 4%, but I would say that some of what I produce is directly attributable to the internet. So there you are. So I think that's probably a lowballing of it. But even within those figures, the GDP of the internet, bigger than Spain or Canada, growing faster than Brazil, and and has a bigger impact at this point on the world than the Industrial Revolution did, particularly over a period of time. Now think about how much the world changed because of the Industrial Revolution. Well, it was just incrementally, right? Each year probably didn't seem all that different from the last. But it was just slightly better during the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And, enough of those years go by, and all of a sudden the world is completely different. So they're saying that actually the Internet is doing it faster than the Industrial Revolution did. So,
well, I think this is a terrific reminder of the fact that we really are in this period of unprecedented transformation in so many ways. And because the economy has been down for a few years now, and we're still suffering from a pretty stalled economic situation right now, and there's all this uncertainty about our economic future. I think those facts tend to obscure the reality, which is that in up or down, our economy is being fundamentally changed. That it doesn't work the way it used to. Interesting comment by Brian here. The internet compares well with the development and commercialization of electric power. That's the level of change we're seeing. Okay, imagine the world that's not powered by electricity, and then the world that is powered by electricity.
It is very similar. Think about, it's information on a wire. In many ways, information empowers everything that we do. It's like plugging into the wall in a way. You know, think what you do, Phil. Here in the United States and in most developed countries, most people work in information jobs. And
yes.
Can you imagine doing? Your job doesn't exist without the internet at all.
I work for a company that sells web software. Okay, so
that is an internet job. Okay, well, my job is, someone could argue, well, you, Stephen, have the same job Abraham Lincoln did before he became president, right? So yeah, you don't need the internet. Bull. I need the internet. I use it to research. In this particular time, sure, maybe maybe in the 19th century you could be an attorney. In the early 20th century you could be an attorney without the internet. But in this day and age, as fast as things are moving, you absolutely require the internet to stay on top of the legal profession. Things are moving way too fast to try to do it with paper books. You just can't do it. Absolutely essential, and that's beyond the marketing aspects of the internet. So
it would be very similar, I think, probably to someone in the early 19th century saying, "Well, President Lincoln got by with candlelight. You don't need electricity to be a lawyer, right?"
Yeah, he read his law books by the light from his fireplace. Yeah, I bet you he would have loved an electric light, and I think he probably would have also liked.
He would have loved
a candlelight.
I'm sure he would have.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
A magical book that could hold any book. I think President Lincoln would have enjoyed that. I think he would have been all over that for sure. It's very interesting to see this happen, and it's cool that a company like McKinsey is taking notice of this and observing that this is real. And I mentioned post scarcity before. This, of course, does play into our whole discussion of post-scarcity, because the interesting difference between the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s and the Internet Revolution is that the Industrial Revolution led to this tremendous ability to produce stuff that required a lot of people being involved and created a huge amount of wealth and a huge amount of economic opportunity that was spread around fairly nicely. In the Internet Revolution, we've got a lot of the same things happening. We've got tremendous productivity occurring, and ultimately, it's no secret that you and I believe, ultimately this leads to a huge ability to produce new stuff, that the amount of wealth that will be produced through this Internet Revolution far exceeds what occurred through the Industrial Revolution, and that ultimately it far exceeds it for individuals, not just for whole economies. But there's this awkward place we're in right now where what the Internet Revolution primarily seems to be doing is taking productive work away from human beings, doing things much more efficiently than they did, theoretically generating a lot of wealth, but in a whole economy, maybe not looking all that friendly to a lot of people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's incredible.
And I think that's one of the issues that we have to continue to deal with. That's something that we have to continue to look at. But I think it's encouraging to see that McKinsey is recognizing the broader trend, because I think the ultimate trend is that productivity goes tremendously up. And, well, you know what I think. We all become sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers, right? And this speaks to the billionaire portion of that equation. But I think you've taken the stance, Stephen, that there might be some trouble between now and then.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're going to go through our awkward adolescent phase. Perhaps we're just beginning to go through our awkward adolescent phase on our way to maturity. It's a time when we, as a culture, we'll have pimples and voices that crack. Yeah, it's things we are maturing, but at the same time we are experiencing all sorts of growing pains as a result of it. And that brings us exactly to the next one. Japan plans solar panels for all new buildings by 2030. Now, Phil, you can probably imagine why Japan might be pushing solar at this moment. They had a pretty bad growing pain here recently, didn't they?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. With the earthquake and the tsunami and the nuclear near disaster, I don't know if you call it a disaster or not, but certainly the terrible condition that their nuclear power plants ended up in, I guess they're heavily invested in exploring alternatives to nuclear at this point. Is that where that's coming from?
Absolutely. And, they're a hugely developed nation. I would say that they're at least as developed as the United States, and in some ways perhaps they're further along than we are in being developed in some ways, especially in robotics and things like that. They need a lot of power. And they just don't have a lot of coal reserves. Everything that has, that stuff has to be brought in. And so nuclear was where it was for them. And they're saying, after this has happened, we've got to figure out something else. And so they're saying, okay, well, here's what we're going to do. All new buildings, 9 years from now, by 2030, that's a few more years than that, 19 years from now. 2030, we're going to make sure that all new buildings have solar in them. So I'm going to think about that. That's, how much power, obviously, we're not just talking about just solar panels on top of a building necessarily. I think what we're talking about there is solar built into all the windows in a glass skyscraper. At that point, it becomes real, because so much of the building can be would be used for producing solar power. So I hope for Japan's sake that they don't turn their back completely on nuclear. I believe that there are ways to do it that are much safer than the plants they had in operation. There are designs that are meltdown proof, pebble bed reactors, things like that. They need to try and phase out some of the older designs that led to this disaster here. But at the same time, I'm excited if Japan pushes solar, and then the rest of the world will benefit. The whole idea of the solar singularity, there are certain places in the world that will experience the solar singularity before any other place. And think about it this way, for example, Hawaii, most of their power, almost all of their power,
right,
is from diesel generators. The solar singularity there has already occurred. It's already cheaper to make solar power solar power is cheaper already than the power that they get from the diesel generators.
We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, right, when we were talking about thorium reactors. I think that came up, yeah.
Right. And then especially sunny places like Arizona, probably already there as far as solar is already cheaper than grid power in some places like that. Japan may since they're an island nation, they may be in much the same shape as Hawaii on that. And so, you know, solar may make a lot of sense for them. Again, I think that they're going to need power in addition to that. And I hope they don't completely shut down all nuclear. Instead, they just go to something safer. And who knows, maybe fusion will come to all of our rescue, too. So,
that's always sitting out there. I don't know if fusion is on our list for tonight, but that's always one of those topics that we end up coming back to. But, I think there's a real possibility that Japan can help lead the way for the world, both in safe new nuclear technology. We were talking about thorium reactors a couple of weeks ago, I think, and if they decide to move in that direction, they can show the rest of the world how it's done, which will be awesome if Japan chooses to do that. And you're right. We talk about this coming solar singularity, which to an extent is the point where solar becomes cheaper than other methods. But I think there's also a tipping point that has to be reached just when solar becomes so ubiquitous, when it's just so well understood that we're getting the benefit from it. Kind of like you were talking about on thermoelectric earlier, when suddenly the idea just catches on. Everyone says, well, why would we not do this? The power is there. Let's take it. So obvious in the case of the sun. It's shining down on us every day. It's all this energy that we could be using that we're not using. I think a big enough proof of concept of its viability to really power a big industrial power like Japan, that can push us a long way towards true adoption of solar, maybe even through a true solar economy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, well, let's get the next one, Phil. I believe it's your turn.
Okay, so our next one is NASA announces results of epic space-time experiment. Man, I love, you can't beat a headline like that, okay? So, and the story starts out with just one of these all-time great deadpan lines. Einstein was right again. There is a space-time vortex around Earth, and its shape precisely matches the predictions of Einstein's theory of gravity. So this is an experiment that researchers have done, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong because I'm just looking at this for the first time, but I believe what they have demonstrated is the effect that gravity has on space-time, I've seen this explained before where any object with a gravity well, any large object like the planet Earth or anything, sits in space-time. It's like putting a ball bearing in a rubber sheet, and it's distorting both space and time.
Right.
And
yeah, if let's think of it this way,
it slows down time. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, if we took this rubber sheet and you grabbed the corner, I grabbed the corner, Ken grabbed the corner, and Sally grabbed the corner, and we stretched it out as far as we could. Somebody dropped a golf ball in the middle of that sheet, then it would be just a slight dimple in our simulated space-time continuum. But you throw a bowling ball in the middle of that, then it would warp that rubber sheet quite a bit, wouldn't it? I mean, it probably would extend down towards the floor. That's that's exactly what they're seeing here. And they did it by putting up a probe that they're calling Gravity Probe B. So it was a probe that they sent out.
It must have been a gravity probe A at some point. I'm thinking.
Yeah, apparently, yeah. And it didn't work out, so they went with a gravity probe B. I'm reminded of the joke in the Austin Powers movie. We went with preparation H on this. Preparations A through
exactly,
D didn't work
yes.
out. Yeah. Anyway. So gravity probe B told us what we were looking for. We were looking for some. Some validation for what Einstein said, 50 plus years ago, and we got it. So I thought that's pretty awesome.
So what we demonstrated with this experiment, I assume, is that I'm not sure how they demonstrate that space bends, but you can demonstrate the dilation of time through the use of clocks that should be synchronized that fall out of synchronization due to the distance between the clock in space and the clock on Earth. And I know that that's been done with items in motion in the past. That on spacecraft in the past, they've used the fact that the Apollo space, I believe that this is when this was first demonstrated, it was during the Apollo program, that those were going fast enough that they could detect a very small time dilation occurring for the astronauts on board those Apollo spacecraft. That's one way to distort space time. The other one is just to have gravity and provide the exact effect that you just described, which is gravity warping and distorting space time. But does it explain how they demonstrated the warping of space?
Well, let me just read this. This is going to be kind of a little bit mind-blowing because we're talking fourth dimensional. Because, you know, the rubber sheet is that's a three-dimensional object, right, where we're describing in three dimensions what is really occurring in four dimensions, okay, with gravity. But let me just read this to you. If Earth were stationary, that would be the end of the story, but Earth is not stationary. Our planet spins, and the spin should twist the dimple in space-time slightly, pulling it around in a fourth-dimensional swirl. That is what GPB, Gravity Probe B, went to space in 2004 to check. The idea behind the experiment is simple. Put a spinning gyroscope into orbit around Earth with the spin axis pointed towards some distant star as a fixed point, reference point. Free from external forces, the gyroscope's axis should continue pointing at that star forever. But if space is twisted, the direction of the gyroscope's axis should drift over time. By noting this change in direction relative to the star, the twist of space-time could be measured. In practice, this experiment was tremendously difficult, but the four gyroscopes on Gravity Probe B are the most perfect spheres ever made by humans. And he goes on to explain the whole thing there. Just remarkable what they were able to accomplish. It took forever, and it was a hard experiment to do.
It's so impressive just how inventive these scientists can be in thinking up ways to figure this stuff out. You know, it's like, well, we know that space-time is being warped. Now, how are we going to demonstrate that? There's something terribly cunning about coming up with a test that will actually demonstrate that. And here they not only came up with it, but they conducted it, and the results came back, and yes, space-time is warped in the fourth dimension, and they were able to demonstrate that.
Exactly as predicted. So I guess the thing that makes this futuristic is that we understand our universe just a little bit better. So there you have it.
Yeah, well, anytime we validate or invalidate a major piece of theory, like that, it's a major step forward. I mean, it feels like a step back when you invalidate something, but actually, of course, it is a step forward because that's your opportunity to clean up your theory. But going back to the opening line here, right? Einstein was right again. I think everyone was assuming he was, but it's helpful to have that validation at that point because it's been like, well, that's one less thing you need to worry about having to correct later. That theory is actually tested out, that it actually pans out in real life phenomena, and on to the next set of tests.
Absolutely. All right. Well, it's my turn.
So what do we got next?
Next, imaginary phone technology lets you operate a cell phone by pressing imaginary buttons on your palm. So
let me tell you the great thing about an imaginary phone. Okay, I have a 2-year-old. And she is often talking on an imaginary phone. Not only does an imaginary phone provide all the benefits that I'm sure they describe here, but it lets you talk to anybody, anytime. And that's really cool because she's always on the imaginary phone with her grandmother or her older sister. Or I believe she was talking to Minnie Mouse the other day on her imaginary phone. Is that what we're talking about here? Because I think those are great. Well, everyone should have one.
Yeah, those are great. And I love it when kids start using phones like that. I love when my last child, Andrew, started mimicking us on the phone. It was so funny. He'd like pick up the phone and just jabber. And it was before he could actually talk, but he would jabber in the same tones that we would when we were on the phone. And then he would do like a little fake laugh, like jabber, 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 jabber. Jabber, jabber.
Yeah, he's got the intonation down. He's got the cadence.
He had it down. It was great. No, what we're talking about here, obviously, is our actual phone that there's no physical manifestation of, okay? So, you know, I'm wearing, let's say I'm wearing, like, a pair of glasses, and I'm dealing with augmented reality here, okay? And so I'm ready to make a phone call. I look at the palm of my hand, and in reality, the palm of my hand doesn't have any numbers on it. But in augmented reality, it sure does. I see all the numbers and everything, and I can dial the phone with the numbers that I see on the palm of my hand. I do all the functions I would normally do with a cell phone, or shoot you. You know, it doesn't have to be a cell phone. It could be anything else, couldn't it? It could be a calculator. It could be a computer. It could be anything. But that's what they're, you know, obviously that's what they're shooting for first, is to actually make a cell phone that, you know, is like maybe embedded into your glasses or something. And then, you know, that's when it just disappears altogether into your glasses.
I'm really interested in this from a design perspective. What do you see in those glasses? When you look at your hand, do you see that you're holding a phone? Do you see kind of a ghost phone? Do you just see some buttons suspended in the, you know what I mean? It's like what constitutes the visual experience of using an imaginary phone?
Well, at this point, I think it's really, really basic. I think you're just seeing numbers on the palm of your hand, and then you dial the numbers by pressing the palm of your hand where those numbers are. But, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be any particular limit to what you could do with that, right? And I can imagine you could change the experience to suit yourself, just like you would change a ringtone. You know, you like seeing, you know, an old-fashioned type phone. You know, like, you know, in front of you, then, hey, you do it. But, you know, that's, and you could have that like a skin or something put into the system, right? Why, there would be no reason you couldn't do that. It's just software. So,
sure. Yeah. You could have it look like anything you want it to look like. I see in the article here that they also are working on replacing a TV remote control with an imaginary zapper. I like the idea of that, just kind of pointing your fingers and redirecting the TV. But it's interesting in an age where we've got smartphones that do so many things, right? I mean, a telephone is a pretty simple device as originally conceived, and even a mobile phone from a few years ago before we turned them, you know, basically used phone as a platform for putting all of computing technology onto it. But it's interesting to think where that might be going, right? Where the whole interface and the whole interaction might be occurring in your eyes, might be occurring in an interface that's visual rather than requiring any equipment at all. Because if you can have a telephone in your hand, why can't you have an iPhone in your hand, right? You know what I'm saying? So that suddenly you're looking at your hand and you're seeing everything that would be in the iPhone, all your Kindle books, your iTunes, you know, Angry Birds, just whatever you happen to have going on in there. I mean, I've got so many things going on my iPhone, work stuff, and it's all there in the palm of your hand, only this time you're not holding anything in the palm of your hand. You just happen to be seeing it there. And, of course, if you're seeing it there, you could be seeing it anywhere. It wouldn't even have to necessarily be projected on your hand.
Yeah, it could be on the desk in front of you. The whole desk could become a workspace. And, you know, with augmented reality. So, I've told you a couple of times, Joel, why so far I haven't gone and gotten my eyes fixed. I could go and have it done and get rid of my glasses. True,
right.
Geeky reason for not doing that. I know that I'm going to be needing the frames again in a few years anyway. So. what's the point?
You're
going
to need those frames to be projecting all this information into your head.
That's right, and I'm absolutely convinced that we'll go through a period of time where everybody will be wearing frames, and I would guess that period of time would last, you know, maybe 5 years or so, and then the frames would disappear again. But you
because
know,
they're
going to
pump it straight into your optic nerve, right? I mean,
exactly, yeah. So you know, it might be contact lenses for a while, and then after that, it's embedded in our heads somehow. But you know. For a period of time, the entire world will be wearing frames. And so, I'm just ahead of the curve. Yeah. So, there you go.
Always, Stephen, always. Well,
we got three things and we got to hit them all.
Yeah. we're real close on the time. Was there one more of these that you wanted to hit just real fast, or are we out of time? I think you wanted to gloat about the Kindle thing.
Yeah, real quickly, I want to gloat about Kindle thing, but I want to hit all three real quick. Amazon.com now selling more Kindle books than print books. Ha ha! I win our bet. Number next. Fascinating attempt at interspecies two-way communication with self-aware beings. Okay, what that is basically we're building a translator that will translate the clicks of dolphin pods and so that we can understand what they're saying, and then when we talk back, it'll put it in dolphin language, and so we can speak to one another.
We
got to
get Dvorsky on and have a whole show about this, huh? This is amazing.
Yeah, he's huge on that. That's his big deal.
Yeah.
And the last thing I got to hit, we can't not mention this. I remember a few shows ago when we were talking about the huge thing with IBM's Watson. You know, the thing we talked about the most, where this thing's going next. We were absolutely right.
Right.
I hadn't heard about it. But, okay, here's the deal. IBM Watson now is going to get its MD degree. They've got all kinds of medical students and things like that volunteering time, feeding medical journals, all sorts of medical information into the Watson system. They intend to make Watson the best diagnostician in the world. So there you
awesome.
Go. So and look forward to that day when our doctors, the doctor in your local office, can be as good as at determining what your illness is, Phil, or my illness. As any doctor anywhere, because he is being aided by Watson, so or one of his descendants. So there you have it. The future
talk about
is
a
now,
tremendously
man.
Useful application for this language recognition, artificial intelligence technology that they've developed. I can't think of a better one or a more needed one than that, or one that I think would have a more profound, potentially more profound impact on society, on so many things. That's a wonderful piece to end with, Stephen. The future really is now. If we've got if we're graduating artificial intelligences from winning game shows to helping to care for us, to helping us to solve our most critical health problems, then I think we're definitely living in the future.
Absolutely. So, at any rate, great show tonight. I really enjoyed tonight's show. There's nothing more encouraging than just to hit a bunch of things that, to remind us that, hey, things are coming along. We hear on the regular news all the time how terrible things are. There's lots of great things are happening, too. We just don't – they're just not emphasized. So
they're not emphasized, and that's what we're here for, is once in a while to point those things out. Well, I'm glad we – glad we got a chance to do that. What's our music this evening?
Okay, the music is Gold by Kaylee Go.
Gold by Kaylee Go?
That's right.
All right, looking forward to listening to that. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. And thanks to everyone who participated in the program this evening, in the chat room, and who are listening otherwise. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. I'll be back on Saturday with the World Transformed 1.5. Don't know if I'll be back Wednesday, but I will be back in the near future. Until then, Stephen's got things well in hand. Look forward to being with you all again either next week or for the beginning preview of the World Transformed. In any event, I hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming programs. And until next time, live to see it.